First is more about breath meditation and daily practice with breath meditation. I'll try to cover that first. Why is it that more persistence, more often, is better practice? For example, meditating 15 minutes morning and night daily instead of a few hours once a week. So I'm assuming the person who wrote that has some experience of doing a long session once a week or trying to do shorter sessions daily. So mindfulness is actually one of the sankharas. It's a karmic formation. It's something that is volitionally, we said it, we have to have the intention to be mindful. And when we do it consistently, that means that there is more mindfulness, being something that's karmically generated. It's like you're giving birth to a thing, a quality, a condition, consciously, which is very good. As far as conditions go, this is one of the very best conditions. It's part of the Eightfold Path, so one of the best conditions to give rise to. With anything, with any condition, it's a consistency. There's that sense, isn't it? It's like I like to use the, in less technical terms, I like to use the simile of charging a battery. Like for your phone, for example, if you do your meditation in the morning, then that quality that you've been generating, you can carry it through throughout the day. And then if you do it again in the evening, then you're going to go to sleep with some mindfulness. And when you wake up, also there'll be a little bit of mindfulness there, more mindfulness there when you wake up than if you hadn't meditated. So it's in terms of, you can see it like that, like basically making an effort to do something with more consistency, then you get a more consistent result. Now, sometimes if someone's really trying to do a two-hour meditation once a week, you might find that after an hour and a half, you might get some deeper peacefulness than if you've just done the 15 minutes. This is because this is just about determination, isn't it? It's like you stick with it and stick with it and stick with it, and at a certain point, if one is sincere in that effort, hindrances will fall away or get much lighter. And then you might get some more samadhi. So this is the difference, as if with longer sessions, it's more likely that there'll be some samadhi there. But in terms of for busy lay people, I think the smaller sessions more consistently is a good standard. Keeping an eye on what's going on in the mind throughout the day, making less karma around reactivity and having more patience. But what I would really suggest is if we can establish this, 15 minutes morning, 15 minutes afternoon, and this is a good standard, a really good standard to maintain, but you'll probably find it's not that difficult to then take it to the half an hour point. And then you don't have to push that though, we're just seeing the benefits of it. Like once you're actually at the cushion, you're on the cushion, you're there, you're doing the practice, then just give it that little bit extra time. You'll find probably a bit more samadhi, at least on some days, and even more resilient mindfulness throughout the day if you can. And what I was saying to people as well is that in terms of, it's good to have like a long-term kind of, you know, short-term goals, intermediate goals and long-term goals for your practice. So you don't have to push it too much, but it is generally good to be intending to do more and more. The older that you get, the more experience that you develop. So 15 minutes twice a day, I would hope, would become half an hour twice a day. And then a little bit later, I would hope that would become 45 minutes twice a day. And as we see the benefits more and more, it's not that unreasonable. As we develop more mindfulness, that we develop more focus, that could become an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening. As we learn to put aside things that aren't helpful, things which, the more mindfulness we have, we'll actually start to notice what is it that I do in my life throughout the day that is helpful, or what's just wasting time, what's supporting my efforts at meditation and what's actually harming them. So the more we meditate, we actually begin to notice that maybe you used to think that 2 hours of television was helpful for relaxing. you might discover that an hour of meditation is more relaxing. And then I was also saying to people that I hope, and it's good to set the intention, because intention is very powerful. If we set the intention, well, at least things have a possibility. If we don't even set the intention, there isn't even a possibility. So set the intention that at some point, even as lay practitioners, hopefully that you'll be meditating 3 times a day. Because if you can meditate morning and then afternoon and then evening every day, then you have a very sincere and serious spiritual practice where you'll be kind of clearing out negative qualities, types of delusion, decreasing the karma that we're making with these forms of delusion, and then increasing these path factors, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. So the power of the path, the Eightfold Path that we're walking, is developing more power in our own minds. So we can set that as an intention at least, that at the very minimum we do 50 minutes morning and evening, or a longer session once a day, when we can increase that twice a day, and have the intention to increase it to 3 times a day. And at least that's some recommendations. Is it best to stick with one mantra, example Buddha? I think it's good not to change around too much. So if something basically works good enough, then I think it's fine. I think Buddha is beautiful. There's so many connotations to Buddha. Such a beautiful meditation. Parikama is called in Pali. Mantra is a Sanskrit word, but Parikama Pavana is when we're maintaining a recollection in the mind. So Buddha, the one who knew ultimate truth, the one who was always mindful, with boundless compassion also. So Buddha also had ocean-like compassion. So that word, it has a lot of nuance, so you can contemplate different aspects of Buddha, and then you can then empower that word with that meaning. It's like you make it meaningful for yourself. So which aspect of Buddha are you going to contemplate while you do Buddha? So you can even use Buddha while doing compassion. You think the Buddha had ocean-like compassion, and just admiring that, recollecting these qualities, then the mind can take on some of that quality. But I do use different mental noting methods for different practices. So for myself, I try to use the breath as the main kamatan, the main meditation object, and then changing the words. But the intention is to be mindful of the breath, and then using the breath, and then with various things. So with mindfulness of breathing, we're just aiming on being consistently mindful of the feeling, and then dropping other things, not picking up the hindrances, not following the hindrances, allowing those, putting those down, using the breath to come inwards and dropping away our fascination with the eyes and the ears and the nose and the tongue and the body, just pulling away from that, 6 sense bases, coming inwards, using that breath. And Buddha helps us restrain thinking. So it helps the thinking mind, it gives it something to do. And whatever wholesome, there may be some thoughts around Buddha, but there will be wholesome connotations, incredibly powerful and wholesome word. But I have, as we've all been practicing together, we're using may I be well, may I be happy, may I be free from suffering in conjunction with the breath. So if you change the words, you change it because it's getting in touch with the intention that you're setting with this particular meditation. So when we're practicing compassion, the words that we use hopefully to set the keep us in our theme and to keep us clear within that theme, and to set a resonance, set an intention, so the words are about compassion or to help stimulate compassion. Similarly with loving kindness, may I be well, may I be happy. And with death, but doing it with the breath. And with death, I often use the word maranang, because it's easier than saying, I could die today. So you just use it. Maranang means death and dying. So I just train myself to understand maranang, maranānusati. Maranang is dying. So then, death. So we use that word when we're recollecting death, using it like that. But in general, try to stick with, if you choose Buddha, try to stick with that. And if you choose may I be well, may I be happy, try to stick with that. Something that can happen is it can seem a bit dry or seem a bit boring, and then we might get this sense that we want to change. We want it to be interesting again. What to do rather than change at that time is have a look. And I've said this often, so that phrase, may I be well, may I be happy, they're not particularly amazing words. Happy. So I don't even know if spiritual practice is, if the goal is actually to be happy, actually. For me, it's more about peace, serenity, contentment. It's more about not suffering. So happiness is another, so in a way it's a kind of an extreme. If it's like the laughing and rolling around on the ground kind of happiness, and then so it's a matter of investing those words with meaning. So what does it mean to you to be happy? So we have to ask those questions. We have to bring it to life again with our own skillful reflection. So what does it mean to me to be well? What does it mean to me to be happy? And then really charge that word up with special meaning for yourself. Same with Buddha. You know, who was the Buddha? What does it mean to be a Buddha? What qualities did the Buddha have? These very qualities that I'm trying to cultivate: wakefulness, peacefulness, mindfulness, wisdom, present moment awareness, a lack of confusion, clarity, a lack of delusion. Wonderful. So we kind of recollect again and again, what was Buddha? What did he discover? What's special about Buddha? And then, of course, the other connotation to that word is our own potential. Most people are aspiring for arahantship, wanting to be liberated quickly, but it's actually possible to aspire to be a Buddha oneself, if you want to, if you're prepared to invest a few extra million lifetimes. You too can be a Buddha. That's not an easy outcome, but it can be very encouraging to just think about that in terms of potential, because we're so often looking negatively on ourselves. So we're often inhibiting or diminishing our potential with our habitual critical thoughts. I'm so stupid. I'm so lazy. And so it's good to balance that. So, no, I'm not. I'm a potential Buddha. You have to sometimes put up a bit of a fight. Because these habits, they can get very heavy, they can get very oppressive. And it's like, I'm so lazy, I'm so stupid. Yeah, but in not very long, I'm going to be an arahant. Because I'm cultivating the Eightfold Path, and which is a path of conditions, and it's going to have this result. So, you know, we can challenge these things. Challenge our habits by using these words, really invest them in meaning, and then bring the meditation back to life. Now, someone's asking a question: the difference in quality and purpose of the in and out breaths. So really, the purpose in mindfulness of breathing is just to be aware of those physical feelings as they are. Mindfulness of breathing. In that process, as we all know, you come to the meditation cushion and there are hindrances present often. And there is often in the space where the breath is, in that very same space, there's layers of thoughts and emotions kind of banging around and being recycled. So it's not easy to just be mindful of the breath. So what I try to do is I also use the breath as a tool within this process of simply trying to be mindful of the breath. So generally, with the in-breath, trying to bring fresh awareness in with that moment, bringing fresh awareness in, making that kind of intention to truly be in that center of your conscious experience with the in-breath. And then with everything else that's going on, I try to use the out-breath, okay, put that down, because that's, you know. So training, at least in the first 5 or 10 minutes, really intentionally bringing the mind inwards, trying to stay inward, And then the thoughts, the feelings, whatever is lingering about the day or yesterday, what we heard on the news, what your friend told you, putting that all down with the out-breath. And then as the thoughts hopefully begin to come down a bit and the emotions settle, then it's just a matter of maintaining the awareness on the feeling as it is. And then how can one best work with the gap in between? So this is really just a matter of staying still. It's a matter of not doing anything. And this is hard, especially as our cultures have got more complex, our societies have got more complex. Generally, people have got more busy, this whole multitasking thing, and most people don't even challenge that. It's actually seen to be a good thing to be able to do a whole bunch of things at the same time. And so to just stay still is a particular challenge, but that's really what it's about. I'm mindfully aware of the in-breath, just staying there without doing anything. And then mindfully aware of the out-breath. Now you'll find if there's a little bit of samadhi, a little bit, just moments of samadhi, those gaps are delicious. It's so nice. It's much nicer than doing lots of things at once to not do anything at all. It's much nicer. It's more rewarding. It's more nourishing. It's peaceful. But we have to train ourselves to do that. And we can notice what's it like when we don't. What's it like the mind's kind of wanting to do something, wanting to go out, think about the future, think about someone else. And so, how does that feel? Restless and agitated. Noticing that. And what does it feel like when it just stays there? So we have to train ourselves to notice, okay, it's more peaceful if we just stay. So we just set that intention of just staying. So different people's minds, you know, we tend to collect or settle in different parts of the body. Now that's interesting. So for myself it's in the heart area, but that's not the case for everybody. Some people the mind kind of gathers and collects in the area of the nose. For other people it's in the abdomen area. So that's like the base of the awareness or the center of the meditation experience. So for you, you have to pay attention at the gap, at when the mind's beginning a little bit peaceful, where is it gathering in the body? Which part of the body is it gathering? Is it in the nose area, or is it in the heart area, or is it in the abdomen area? Some people it's even in the solar plexus area, so it's different for different people. So that's where you want to stay. Wherever it is that the mind is gathering, wherever it is that it feels most peaceful, that's where you want to keep the mindfulness in those spaces. So just stay in that place. And, one person was explaining that while doing compassion meditation, that it was the mind kept thinking about other people, and that it was easier, or there was a tendency to focus on others and not oneself. Is this wrong? I don't think it's wrong. I think probably, I'm not sure who, can I ask who wrote that question? Okay. So sometimes we train in, and I just wanted to see if this is what happens. Sometimes when we train in the Brahma-viharas, we train in may all beings be free. We go straight to that, especially in the chanting. We go to that. And so we haven't trained in including ourselves in all beings. So if there's a habit, if we've trained, compassion means for all beings, then, you know, through that repetition, that's where it will go. I think ultimately the most efficient way to cultivate compassion is spending some time there on oneself first and then radiating it outwards. So I don't think it's wrong, I think it's beautiful, but I think the results will be deeper and better if you really establish it in your own heart and then radiate it outwards. Sometimes some people have blockages. Sometimes it's easier to get a feeling for compassion for other people than it is for oneself. So sometimes we can do that. We can think about other people, generate some compassion for other people, and then you turn that very compassion in. Okay, that includes you too. So that we train ourselves not to withhold any of these divine abidings from ourselves. Yourself, you as one of all beings. You as one of all beings who suffer, and you as one of all beings who want to be free from suffering. And then just understanding that if you can really hold it in that heart area, that's the space that it's going to radiate from. So it's good to just spend a bit of time on that as the foundation practice, radiate it outwards afterwards. And one person is asking, what qualities should I have to be a good Dharma friend? So that's a good question, isn't it? And if we have compassion for people, it has more implications, compassion, than loving kindness. It's a bit trickier. There's a bit of a hook there. Something about feeling a little more responsible. So with loving kindness, radiating beautiful, fluffy, warm, loving energy outwards, but not necessarily having to do something to help. Although loving kindness is helpful, I'm not saying it's not, but compassion is like when we make the wish, may this person be free from suffering, may they be free from suffering, the obvious next question is, what can I do to help them to be free from suffering? Once we actually start thinking about it, there's implications. And so to be a good Dharma friend would mean, so this is the thing, is like when people are suffering, and we all like sympathy when we're suffering, don't we? And then this is tricky. So one thing I also, anyone who's a senior monk now becoming an abbot, you hear a lot about suffering, and it's which is fine. It's actually helpful. It's being in this position, you couldn't. I don't even know if you could go a day trying to believe that suffering didn't really exist in the world, because people are often sharing with you various types of suffering, and empathizing with the suffering without indulging a bad behavior, without indulging an unskillful attitude, this is tricky. This is in the realm of true spiritual friendship. It's how do you offer empathy for suffering without offering support for delusion? I don't know, good luck. No, I'm joking. So we have to be careful, don't we? So it's like in the sense of, okay, I see you're suffering, I really wish you'd be free from suffering, but you know what? If you hadn't called him an asshole, he might not have punched you. It's like, sometimes it really comes down to that, doesn't it? It's like you have to point out to people the behavior that they sometimes do that elicits reactivity. It's like, yeah, it is terrible, but if you hadn't maxed your credit cards on all of those nice clothes season after season, you might not have had the car repossessed. A good spiritual friend will offer support when a person is suffering, for the suffering, and then will in a timely, if we're aware that a person's own speech, own thoughts, own behavior are very much a part of what caused that suffering, then we will, in a timely manner, and being very careful of our intention, try to offer some advice or feedback about how that person might not cause that kind of suffering in their life anymore. So that's like how to manage their own emotions a bit better, or their own resources a bit better, their own reactivity a bit better. So a good spiritual friend will encourage people to do the good things that they're doing. So that's like supporting that which is good, having mudita, appreciating that which is good, supporting that. And suppose a person then has some good practices and they fall to the wayside, well then we remind them, well, remember when you used to do this and you used to do that and you used to really enjoy that, and why don't we go to the temple together, or why don't we do this retreat together? So if someone's falling off the rails, that you try to bring them back on the rails. And then whatever is unskillful, we don't support that, and try to give genuinely sound advice if it's helpful. And then, as we'll all be aware, people have thresholds for how much truthfulness they can handle. And so we also, if we're a friend, we don't want to push it too much. We just kind of know what level of feedback a person can take. And we're humbly aware that we're the same. We don't want someone coming in pointing out all of our faults with beautiful, meticulous clarity, and explaining to us all of the things we could do to improve ourselves. So it's the right amount, isn't it? And, anyway, probably said enough. Were there any other questions? Give people the opportunity to ask any questions about the compassion meditation, about anything else?
Ajahn, you talked about the blockages that people have.
It's okay. She's shy. It's okay. Yeah, I can hear. I'll repeat the question. It's okay.
So, the blockages and why is it that, you know, sometimes it's hard to radiate that, you know, loving kindness to yourself because I struggle with that quite a lot.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm glad you mentioned that. So, we're talking about emotional habits. So we all have emotional habits. And loving kindness and compassion aren't what most of us are socially conditioned to have a lot of in this day and age. Some cultures, particularly Buddhist cultures, when they're, you know, this is the Bahramian merit of the Buddha, this field of merit, when it's really happening in a culture, people are hearing these teachings and doing these chantings and doing retreats and doing meditations, well then you can get periods of time in a culture where Brahmaviharas are very prevalent. And I still think in Thailand, in this day and age, that there's a lot of loving kindness just there. And it's not talked about that much. It's not taught that much because most people know what it is and kind of know how to do it. In our culture, I don't think that is the case. So Western Judeo-Christian culture is very discriminating, very intelligent, and it discriminates. And I was explaining, I think, in the talk last Sunday that there is this big volume of psychopathology, which is this thick, that all of the things that can be wrong with people's various types of neuroses. So our culture masters in, you know, we have a PhD in knowing what's wrong. And then what that does is actually, there's probably little moments of dosa in our consciousness, often anger. So when we're fault finding, whether that's the government's policies, whether it's corporations' policies, whether it's our friends, whether it's religions, just that knowing what's wrong, or knowing how it should be, and then also the self-righteous anger. So that's very big in our culture as well. So that's wrong, and I'm right. And there's little moments of anger there. This becomes habitual, and then everyone else is doing it around us as well. There's a lot of that in our culture, so there is a habitual tendency towards anger and fault-finding. And then the more we do that, sometimes it's not so conscious, but I think it's just a karmic result, that if something in here is looking outside saying, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, that's wrong, it comes home to bite us. Something's looking inwards and saying, that's wrong. It's the very same habit as like ill will aimed inwards. And that can become like just a habitual background attitude. I think it's pervasive in many people. So that's what's wrong with the government, and that's what's wrong with them, and that's not right, and that's not right, and neither is this. That's what's wrong with this, and it's not right, it's not good enough. So that I think many people have that. We come to meditation as just that sense of expert fault finders, and we're not free of that. We can't step out and know what's wrong with everything else without harming ourselves. We get harmed in the process. Shooting all these bullets. We're getting shot.
Well, also, I guess, now, if you look at the precepts and keeping the precepts and being a good person and you've set a standard, you've set a bar, and if you go outside that, then you criticize yourself.
Right, okay.
It's that... You know,
it's funny because Thais don't do that so much. So it's not necessary that because we're trying to aspire to something good, it's not necessary that when we don't meet that you'd add the extra bit. That I think is cultural. So one of the reasons Thais love monks so much, we talked about this a couple of months ago, is because you know they can do things that most Thais can't. And so they admire that. It's like, wow, celibacy. Wow. That's not what most Thais are doing. And so they respect it. So rather than hate what they can't do, they just really appreciate, they see that, oh, that is a difficult thing, that's special, and then they really appreciate it when they see it in others without... But this is the thing, it's like, suppose one has trained in mudita and one has faith, and then one's going to appreciate that good thing that one is inspiring to, at least when one sees it in others, rather than hating the absence of it here. But it's like, the thing is, it is a workable situation. It's like just the fact that and these meditations hold a torch to it. It's like, oh, there's a block there. I'm feeling something which isn't compassion towards myself. I'm feeling something which isn't loving kindness towards myself. And then you need to challenge that with a bit of, I think it's wisdom, right view, and it's more like samsaric perspective. So I'd use that phrase, a sense of, well, here I am trying to train with the five precepts sincerely, and I make mistakes. And then we just understand that it's thousands of lifetimes of habits, possibly millions of lifetimes of making karma with energies which are not self, but come back. So when you get the sense of, and the monks are the same, we've got a lot of rules, and we find ourselves sometimes breaking the minor rules. We have to confess fortnightly, I'm still breaking this rule after 15 years. You know, it's like, it comes up, and there's a sense of, and you get a glimpse of it. It's like, you know, samsara is long, our habits are deep, and at certain times it's appropriate to actually ask, okay, among the 6 billion human beings currently on the planet, how many people are making a genuine effort to be ethical? So this is like a different kind of skillful reflection. So sometimes we hold up the Sangha and enlightened beings' standard of virtue when we want to be inspired about what it produces, you know, the radiance, the lack of remorse, the purity. You know, that's to get inspired about doing it. When we find that we're losing heart because of this struggle and we keep breaking the rule, but then sometimes we have to pat ourselves on the back. And it's like, well, of the 6 billion human beings, not very many are making a sincere commitment to really training with something. And then we also understand that these five precepts, they are a training. So it's not that you broke it once and you failed. It's not a test. It's that you recognize. It's like it is holding a bar. That's your standard, and you want to be at that level, but when you're not, you understand that you're training. So you want to be there more often than you used to be. What I'm trying to say. So what it comes down to, oftentimes, is breaking that precept less often. It's not a matter about never breaking it anymore. If one has come from a situation where one was breaking some of the precepts often, then the beginning of the practice may very well be breaking it less often, or breaking it in ways which are less coarse, and then actually looking at the benefit of that. It's like, well, you actually have to look at the happiness that you experience when you don't break it, the well-being, the confidence, the dignity. So we have to train ourselves, look at the result, you're training the mind, look at that, look, you're actually happier when you don't break that precept. So that's encouraging, you have to learn to encourage it as a training. And then sometimes we break a couple of precepts and don't meditate, we can go out and break more because it's like a rebellion thing, or you get fed up, you know, you can kind of, okay, trash it. So that's really dangerous, and you don't want to feed that mind state. You have to train your mind to see the benefits of it. And then it's just being gentle. It's like, it's okay, I think Jasmine was saying a couple of months ago, that we are children. We are children. You don't have to expect yourself to be an arahant yet, and we are, so we try to offer the kind of attitude and attention that you give a child. So it's like, we do make mistakes, we aren't perfect, we're learning. So, and in the beginning stages of meditation, this can be really painful. The better part of you knows why you shouldn't do a thing, and yet that other part which really wants to do it might in moments be more powerful. And so there's a little part of you going, you know, I really shouldn't do this, and but I'm going to do it. Come on, we've all had that experience. And then it's scary, that's what we're up against, the power of the kilesa. You know, I shouldn't, I know I regret it, but you know what? we've all been there. And then it's like, so try to offer kindness to that, kindness to, and as much firmness as we can, but it's a gentle firmness. So it never comes from hating the self. It never comes from being angry at the self. Anger does have a role to play sometimes. You want to get angry at kilesa. So this is Ajahn Mahabua style. This is Ajahn, a very famous fiery forest monk in Thailand. People were petrified of him, I was. But my teacher explained to me, he's not angry at the being, he's angry at the kilesa. So the negative qualities which are affecting beings' minds, that's what he's scolding. And he could be really fiery. I went to pay respects to him as a novice, with a couple of other monks, and in front of hundreds of people he goes, "Oh, here's the Western monk again." And then we went, as we were paying respects, we had offerings. He says, "I don't want them, I've got too much stuff, what am I supposed to do with it?" So he didn't receive the offerings. You know, these presents and you're on your knees, and, "Oh, I don't want it." But looking at his face, it's like diamond-like eyes, and this incredible radiance. And on an energy level, you feel this incredible love. So it's like you were listening to the word, so he didn't want more stuff. He was an austere person, where you're trying to do conventionally what's appropriate, and you offer something nice, and he scolded us. But if he really was displeased with the monk's standards, he wouldn't raise his hands. But when we were bowing, he did. So we were told afterwards, "Oh, that was really amazing. He actually received your bow." Everywhere else you go, it's just a given that a monk will receive another monk's bow. But apparently for a period of time, Ajahn Mahabua, he wouldn't even accept the bow because he wasn't impressed by the standards. So, you know, he is a kind of an interesting example of the fact that anger can have a place. And you want to... So, anger can become fierce determination. So rather than getting angry at yourself and holding a grudge, you get angry at the kilesa that wants to make you break the precept. So I think Dalai Lama gave an example of someone who used to be a thief before he became a monk. And he saw a beautiful thing, a monk, some lama, they have lots of nice beautiful things in those... you know, the Nepali art and the Tibetan art, all the gold plate and all the jewels. And he was, some lama had some beautiful thing and he was looking at it and he said it was almost unconsciously his hand was like reaching for the beautiful thing. And he said, the Dalai Lama was telling the story. He said, but the other hand grabbed that hand and said, "Stop! Thief!" So it was like, he's saying that, you know, there is a role. So the anger isn't towards, it's towards that quality that's about to do that. A realm of practice for us. But in terms of how to work with it, first of all, there's a lot to be optimistic about because the mind's nature isn't dark and closed and blocked. It's a very spacious thing. So what this would seem to suggest is that that's a temporary experience which is destined to change. And that in general, I would say Brahmaviharas and Bharami are more powerful than Kilesa. This is a wonderful... There's a famous mudra from a monk in Thailand called Somdet Do, very famous monk in Thailand, and he has this mudra. And what that mudra means is the good will always overcome the bad. Fact. So wholesome dhammas are inherently more powerful than unwholesome dhammas. Bharami does defeat kilesa. So the Brahmaviharas are more powerful than dosa. So it's just taking that as the context, the perspective, what you're now beginning to train in will overcome and uproot those negativities. If it's just a matter of being consistent. And it's just really holding with a lot of tenderness. So suppose the loving kindness just isn't happening and the compassion just isn't happening, then the practice is holding that intention right there. So right where it feels blocked and right where it feels hard, it's just holding as much softness as you can with that pure intention, and that will dissolve. But we have to be very patient at that time. So you can't make yourself have boundless loving kindness. sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't in meditation. But that in just having the intention is in itself so pure. And it's already beginning to shift things around. So I think we can be very optimistic, confident, have a lot of faith. The Buddha's recommending these divine abidings as a support to the practice. think I want just maybe 15 minutes of walking meditation, because people have been sitting for a while, and if we do a 45 minute meditation now, you might get very sore. And just, but you can, if you want to, with one foot, may I be free from suffering. With the other foot, may all beings be free from suffering. If you want to begin priming that as a meditation, or metta, may I be well with one foot. With the other foot, may all beings be well. If you can find a little place to walk around. Just 15 minutes. So it's a 1:45 now, and we can start again at 2. Try not to talk though now. Now we're going to come back and do some serious meditation on suffering.